Every year, between early March and late April, about 2,000 hikers set out from Springer Mountain in Georgia to hike the roughly 2,100 miles north to Mount Katahdin in Baxter State Park in Maine on what we know as the Appalachian Trail. Hey, yes. 10% of the 2,000 people make it all the way. Half drop out before they ever pass through Georgia, through Virginia. To say that that is a daunting task, the idea of taking your shelter and everything that you need, obviously you would resupply your food, but everything that you need over the course of 4 months, put it in a backpack, wear it on your back, point your feet north, and just start walking. To say that that is a daunting task is an understatement. And the folks who do this do it voluntarily. No one is making them through hike the Appalachian Trail. And yet every day, for about 4 months, the folks who do it point their feet north with 20, 30 pounds on their back and put one foot in front of the other, step after step after step after step, in hopes of reaching Mount Katahdin in Maine. There are challenges along the way: weather, lack of water, bad water, lack of food, bad gear. Other people you might run into might present challenges along the way. And yet people every year endeavor to make this trek from Georgia to Maine by foot. A couple years ago, a friend of mine set out to through hike the Appalachian Trail. And when he realized, or when his family realized that they were not going to be able to talk him out of this, he's a good bit older than I am. When his family realized that they weren't going to be able to talk him out of this, they just decided, all right, we're going to support him in whatever way possible. They went out and spent time with him on the trail. His son went to hike the trail with him. And I continued to hear reports of success and progress. And, you know, maybe they had some challenges. There were some blisters on the feet. And you know, maybe they'd gotten caught in a storm. But all those things happen when you're on the Appalachian Trail. But things were going well. About 2 months into their trip, they woke up one morning and went through their routine in the same way that they always do. Ate a quick breakfast, began to pack up, and it had become their custom for my friend, the father, to go ahead and pack his stuff quickly and begin his journey ahead of his son so that they could keep a fairly good pace. His son obviously was a stronger hiker than he was, and so he would take his time around camp and get packed up and enjoy the morning sun, and then finally hoist his pack and continue on after his father, who he would catch after an hour or so. Well, one morning they went through this same routine. My friend left camp and began his hike, and his son allowed some time to pass and hoisted his pack and began his hike. And after an hour, he thought, man, my dad is really making good time today. Must have been the mashed potatoes that we ate last night. After an hour and a half, he starts to get a little concerned. After 2 hours, he is terrified that something awful has happened to his father. There are no side trails. There are no wrong turns that he could have made, and yet he had not caught up with him. And so now he's left in the predicament, do I continue to hike on in hopes that maybe he has just had a stellar morning of hiking, or do I turn around and go back? Maybe he left the trail to go to the bathroom and something happened to him. He could be anywhere. I mean, can you put yourself in that place and feel the panic begin to rise as the one person that you're out here with, the one person that you came to support and make sure that they were okay, now you don't know where they are. And you can't call them and ask them where they are. They're somewhere in 2,100 miles of wilderness. So he decides to turn around and head back to where they were camping and hopes that maybe something crazy happened and his dad is back at camp. He reaches camp, he's not there, and he thinks, well, the only thing I know to do is just keep walking in a southerly direction. because I didn't find him when I was heading north. And he rounds a bend and he sees his dad sitting on a rock, physically spent, emotionally spent. His dad was actually, my friend was actually just in tears. And he just said this thing over and over. I went the wrong way. I can't believe I went the wrong way. I'm so foolish. I went the wrong way. I walked in the wrong direction. Instead of coming out of camp and pointing his feet north, he turned the opposite direction. He got turned around. He got confused and started walking south, back the direction that he had come. And when he realized that he started to see things that he had seen, an hour had passed. Miles under his feet. And he was left defeated, waiting for his son, hoping that his son would realize it and come back to find him. I can't believe I went the wrong way. For the past 4 weeks, we've looked at the human life cycle and asked, what can we learn about different stages of life? What can we learn about faith and what it means and what it looks like and how we follow Jesus, or how we even consider what life with Christ is supposed to be? What can we learn from these different stages in life about what it truly means to walk with Jesus? We began at the end with our homecoming years. That moment in life when it is all said and done, when there's this realization that my time is spent. And we ask the question, what would it look like for your life to end well? What would it look like to reach that point and be able to say, I've lived faithfully. I've done all that I could to honor the Lord. And then next we looked at the legacy years. Those years when you realize that your life has an impact on those who follow you. If people were to follow the path that is your life, where would it lead them? If people were to follow the path that is your life, where would it lead them? Would it lead them to Christ and a life of faithful discipleship? Or would it lead them to something else? Then we talked about midlife, that point in life that we reach where we realize the clock is continuing to tick, that time is marching on, and we're not so sure how we feel about it. So we do everything that we can to stay the tide and reverse the effects and go back. And yet Paul contends in his letter to the church in Ephesus that I want you to go on to maturity. That maturing is not a bad thing. That's what we're invited to do, and it's what we're called to do as followers of Christ. He echoed that again last week in his letter to the Corinthians in chapter 3, where Paul says, I'm tired of just giving you spiritual milk. I want you to be ready for something more. I want you to be ready for heavier stuff, and yet you're stuck on this milk. You're stuck eating the things of a child. You're stuck in those adolescent years. You're distracted by the wrong things. And in adolescence, we find that not only do we realize our greatest obstacle of faith, but maybe the greatest tool that we have as well. You see, we get so easily distracted by focusing on the wrong things. The church in Corinth was worried about, and they were having this fight about who follows who. Will I follow Paul? Will I follow Apollos? Paul says, don't you realize that Apollos and I are working for the same thing? Don't get distracted by the little things that don't matter. But be like Jesus, who rather than leaving Jerusalem with his parents when he was 12, stayed in the temple to hear the word, to ask questions, to challenge. Determination. What would it look like for you to live a life of determination in your pursuit of Christ. And this week we approach what I believe is the most difficult season yet. Not difficult like adolescence is to walk through. Like the season itself is not necessarily difficult, but what it teaches us and what it challenges us about in faith is perhaps one of the most difficult things that we can do. And yet, if we want to reach those homecoming years and say, I'm ready for this to end well, or we want to be in those legacy years and say, I believe that if people followed the path that is my life, it would lead them to Jesus, then we must back all the way up to childhood and say it begins there. Yes, it begins in the childhood of your life, but the things that we learn from childhood, to begin to apply those to our journey with the Lord, sets us on a path of faithfulness. Sets us on a path of faithful pursuit of the Lord. Now, if we know where we're going, or if we know where we want to end up, we think that we just point our feet in a given direction and walk and work as hard as we can to get there. I want to be faithful in coming to church. I want to be faithful, and maybe I have the opportunity to have a free Saturday morning, and so I want to go and support the Firewood ministry. Or hey, maybe I've decided that I want to start tithing, or maybe it's not, 10%, but I want to give something because I feel like that's what I'm supposed to do. And so we work really hard, and we try to wake up early and spend time in the Word, and then we get frustrated when that doesn't work out, and we start to beat ourselves up, but we just think, no, if I can just keep walking in this direction, that's where I'm supposed to go. But childhood says, no, you got to turn around and walk in the opposite direction. You can't point your feet north and just work really hard and hope to get there. You have to actually turn around and walk back to where you started. Don't you love that Jesus, a life of following Jesus, is actually always the opposite of what you think it should be? Here's a confession, and maybe this will be a tip to some of you who haven't taken the test for your driver's permit yet. When I took that test, I realized that every answer that I thought was the logical answer was actually the wrong answer. So if you look at the questions and says and say, well, it makes sense that this would be this, it's not that, it's the opposite thing. You're going to have to take it over if you choose every answer that you think is the right answer based on the logic. This life of following Christ is kind of the same. When we think that we work and we push and we strive forward, because that's what we do with everything else that we want to achieve in this world, Christ says, no, I want you to turn around and go back. Be in Matthew chapter 18 this morning. Read the first four verses. If you would, in honor of the reading of God's word, please stand with me. At that time, the disciples came to Jesus and asked, who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? He called a little child and had him stand among them. And he said, I tell you the truth, unless you change and become like little children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Therefore, whoever humbles himself like this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. This is the word of God for us, the people of God. Thanks be to God. So remember last week, we talked about our misplaced focus being one of our greatest obstacles to following Jesus. Take heart in the fact that you are in good company. It doesn't mean that you can continue to misplace your focus, but just know that as you are striving to live a life in which Jesus is your priority, or you're even wrestling with what that means and what that looks like, that Jesus would be your priority, your first desire, you are in good company. There are plenty who have gone before you who have paved the way in that. At that time, the disciples came to Jesus and asked, "Who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" Think about what the disciples are concerned with here. If you have children, if you have more than one child, or if you've spent any amount of time around more than one child collectively, then it is not uncommon at some point for children to begin jockeying for position. If you have a snack for one of them, you better have a snack for all of them. If you praise one of them for the schoolwork that they brought home, you better figure out a way to praise all of them for the schoolwork they brought home, even if it was terrible. Because the moment that they begin to realize, wait a second, he got pretzels, I wanted pretzels, all I got were goldfish. When on any other given day you love goldfish, but they're not pretzels. Jesus' disciples ask him a lot of questions in the course of their time together. This one is a winner. Jesus, who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? Now, what they're really asking is, Jesus, who of us, your followers, the 12 of us, which one of us is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? Basically, Jesus, who's your favorite? Who do you like the most? Who are you most proud of? Whenever you pick a passage in Scripture to read, it's important to read the things that are around it. Because if we back up just a little bit into chapter 17, verses 22 and 23. When they came together in Galilee, he said to them, "The Son of Man is going to be betrayed into the hands of men." This is Jesus talking to his disciples. "They will kill him, and on the third day he will be raised to life." And the disciples were filled with grief. Here's what's crazy. This is not the first time that they've been told this is going to happen to Jesus. In chapter 16, verse 21, "From that time on, Jesus began to explain to his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things at the hands of the elders, chief priests, and teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and on the third day be raised to life." Peter takes him aside and rebukes him. "Never, Lord, this shall never happen to you." Peter's like, "Yeah, not on my watch. I'm going to make sure that you're protected, that you're safe. I don't want you to be killed. This isn't how this is supposed to be." And Jesus rebukes him, basically calls him the devil, and says, "Get behind me. You don't have the things in mind that I have in mind." The disciples are upset. They are filled with grief. Like, it's one thing to be mildly upset about something. It's another entirely to be filled with grief. Grief is heavy. Grief is crippling. Grief hurts. The disciples are filled with grief because they've been told that Jesus, they've been told by Jesus that he is going to give his life up, that he is going to be killed. That kind of grief doesn't go away quickly. The news that you're going to lose someone who is so dear to you, someone that you've given your life to. And yet here, as we read just a few verses later, we see that that's not so much the focus of the disciples anymore. That now they've gotten distracted from the main thing, from the thing that's really important. Jesus just revealed to them why he came. He just let them in on the plan. He just told them what he was here for. Like, that's the one thing he wants them to know. That's the one thing that he wants them to carry on. When he tells them after his resurrection, the end of Matthew in chapter 28, "Go into all nations and make disciples. Go and tell people my story." He's just let them into a really key part of the story, that he came to give his life. Like, that's the, I want you to have that in mind. I want you to have in your heart, followers, the things that I have in my heart. That's what Jesus is trying to convey to them. This is really important, guys. Pay attention. This is the thing that's going to carry this forward. And they get distracted. Because earlier, okay, yeah, Jesus called Peter the devil, but before that, he told him that he was his rock. He's going to build his church on that rock. Well, James and John are like, he didn't tell me that. How come he's just telling Peter that? Well, so, you know, and then they feel a little bit better when you know, Peter's called the devil. They're starting to feel better about themselves. You know, but what about the way that Jesus is treating Judas? You know, Judas hadn't betrayed him yet, so we don't really know what's going on there. You have 12 men who have given their lives to follow Jesus. They are like children, but not in a positive sense of the word. They've allowed themselves to get distracted and focus on the things that don't matter. Not that Jesus came to give his life, and they've somehow been invited into this story. But they're worried about who is the favorite. Who's the best in the kingdom? Jesus, who are you pleased with? When you look at us, who do you like? What are the things that you get distracted by? What are the things that you find yourself worrying about? How often or how much time do you spend comparing yourself to people around you? Or seeing the way that someone's been cared for or carried or blessed or taken care of, and you find yourself saying, well, where's mine? What about me? Haven't I been faithful? And all of a sudden, before we even realize it, our focus goes from the one thing that we really need to be looking at to the one thing that got us in trouble in the first place. And that's us. Me. Mine. My life. Jesus, as he often does, has an answer without ever answering the question. Who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? Jesus sees a child and calls him to stand among them. I wonder what the disciples thought he was going to do with this child. They just asked him a really weighty question. And Jesus sees a child and invites him to come stand in their midst. And he said to them, I tell you the truth, brothers, disciples, followers of mine, unless you change and become like little children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Therefore, whoever humbles himself like this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. Well, that is not the answer that they were hoping for. They were hoping to hear a name, someone's name, just one of us. At least pick one, and then we can argue the point. We can campaign against that, or campaign for this guy that you didn't pick, or I can campaign for myself. But Jesus acknowledges none of them and instead pulls a child into their midst and says, This is the example that you are to follow. Unless you become like this child, you probably ought not to worry about the kingdom, because you're not going to get there. What a harsh response. In so many ways, Jesus didn't just see a cute child playing and want to come and say, look at this beautiful child that I made. But Jesus pulling a child into their midst, in that culture, in first century Roman Jewish culture, Jesus was like placing a crack in the foundation of the way that their culture operated. For Jewish people, a child was a blessing. It's another one of God's people. Another one of God's chosen. That's a good thing. But for Jews who lived in Rome, which were all these people, a child was a liability. Imagine living in that tension. Well, I want to populate the kingdom, and yet every child I have is a liability. I can be taxed for children. They're going to cost me more money. So the way that they operated in that society was, let me grow these kids up as quickly as possible because we need to get them working. At least maybe then we can break even. Maybe they can help kind of pay their way. You know, we're not paying like car insurance here. You got to pay you got to pay your own taxes to live. Sorry. By Jesus bringing a child into their midst and using a child as an example, not only is he calling into question that the disciples were asking, but he's giving new value to children. Jesus spends his entire ministry doing this, placing value on people that this world doesn't value. We often tolerate children. Yes, we love our own. We love them collectively. But there are times when we simply tolerate them. When they're making noise, when they're being disruptive, when they're bothering us when we're trying to do work. We find ourselves tolerating children. If you could just get through the diaper phase, it's wearing me out. Like if you could just start sleeping through the night because I'm turning into a zombie. And yet Jesus says, don't wish it away, because this is what I want you to be like. Now you can make the argument that the disciples were well on their way to being childish, acting like children. But that's not what Jesus is after. Like, I don't want you to be childish. That's what's getting in the way. I want you to be like children. What is he suggesting? And how does this stand up to what we talked about last week? And the week before that? That we're called to go on to maturity, and yet Jesus is saying you need to be like children. Is Jesus wrong, or is Paul wrong? What's happening here? I thought Paul was supposed to be a follower of Christ. I thought that Paul was championing the cause here. And yet he's saying be mature, and Jesus is saying be like a child. If you ever have any hope of being mature as a follower of Christ, you must first become like a child. If you ever have any hope of going forward, you must be willing to go back and start at the beginning. Not just once, but every single day. Children are helpless. Do you allow yourself to be helpless before the Lord? Or are you pretty self-sufficient, allowing God in when it's convenient for you? Children, by their very existence, live in a place of humility. They fully rely on others to care for them and give them what they need. In a child, they learn this eventually, and unfortunately, I think they learn it from us. But before they reach that point, in a child, there's not any jockeying for position. In that stage of innocence, there is nothing in a child that says, I am better than that guy. I deserve more than that one. I am more well-loved than that person. I am a much better color inside the line artist than my friend over there who just makes a mess of his page. Like, there's not any of that in the innocence of a child. And yet we live in a culture that is driven by competition. It's driven by comparing ourselves to other people. And if we can't strive to be better than the people that are ahead of us, we at least want to make sure that we're better than the people who are behind us. And yet Jesus is saying that has no place in my kingdom, because guess what? It's a level playing field. All are sinners. All fall short of the glory of God. All of us, all of you have this deep need for something greater than ourselves that none of our striving and none of our achieving and none of our goal setting and accomplishment can fix. We need Jesus. And before we ever can realize that, and before we can ever receive what he's offering us, we have to be willing to recognize that need. And to humble ourselves before him is the way that that happens. Now be careful, because our temptation is to walk out of this door and say, I'm going to be humble, dang it. I'm going to be more humble than that guy right there. Whatever it takes, I'm going to be the most humble person in the room. The moment you say that is the moment that you are not the most humble person in the room. We have to be careful not to strive for humility, because the moment you start striving to be humble is the moment that you feel pretty good about getting there. Instead, it begins starting in that place of weakness. Not once, but every day of your life. Asking the Lord, Lord, what do you see in me that I don't see? Show me what you see. Show me where there's pride. Show me where there are things about my heart that aren't healthy. Show me my need. It's one of the weightiest prayers that you can pray. Lord, show me my need. The more in touch you are with your need, the more you realize the need of those around you. And the more you realize that, wait a second, this is a level playing field. We're all a mess. Let's be a mess together. That's when the church is most beautiful. A child doesn't try to cover up their mess. Believe me, I have 5 of them. It's like you wear it like a badge of honor. The messier, the better. And yet somewhere along the way, we hit this point where we feel like, oh, I have got to hide that. And Jesus is saying, no, helpless. Humble. Embrace where you are. When Ben and I were meeting this week talking about this Sunday, this message, he made this statement. He said, you know, children have no ideas about themselves that aren't true. And I was like, do you want to preach? Because that's a powerful statement. Children have no ideas about themselves that aren't true. Y'all, we have all kinds of ideas about ourselves that aren't true. All kinds of things that we have bought into, that this world has sold us, that we are buying. All kinds of things that have worked to put us in a place not of humility, but of pride, where we feel pretty good about ourselves. Or we're so beat up by what we've bought into that we don't even feel like we are approachable. Well, guess what? God approached you in Jesus first. He didn't wait for you to approach him. He's already come to you. And perhaps the appropriate response would be like a child who's sitting on the floor as a parent approaches. They reach up their arms because they just want to be picked up. just want to be held. Where is Christ approaching you in your life? When we come to that place, I'll close with this thought. When we come to that place where we allow ourselves to experience weakness and we begin to allow pride to be stripped away and we find ourselves in a place of humility, when we begin to embrace that and really take ownership of that, and we begin to recognize and confess our need for something greater than ourselves because we've exhausted everything that we have and it's not working out for us, then we allow our gaze to rest on the cross and we realize what has been given in the midst of that weakness. What Jesus gave in himself that meets you in the place of your deepest need. When we realize what has been offered to us, our response should be one of praise. Our response should be one that without or with abandon, we give glory to the one who reached into our mess and wants to pull us out of it. The last thing that we learned from children this morning in Matthew 21, I want to invite our worship team to come back up. Matthew chapter 21. Jesus is at the temple. He's just entered Jerusalem. This is the march to the cross. Things are unfolding that will lead Jesus to the cross. Jesus entered the temple area and drove out all who were buying and selling there. He overturned the tables of the money changers and the benches of those selling doves. It is written, he said to them, my house will be called a house of prayer, but you are making it a den of robbers. The blind and the lame came to him at the temple and he healed them. Those, the less fortunate, those that society cast out, those that are weak and that are forced into a place of humility, those are the ones that are coming to Jesus. Do you see what's happening here? But when the chief priests and the teachers of the law saw the wonderful things he did and the children shouting in the temple area, Hosanna to the Son of David. The children shouting in the temple area. The children aren't running and fleeing because of what Jesus is doing. They're not upset by it. They are giving praise. They are shouting out, Hosanna to the Son of David. The teachers of the law were indignant. Do you hear what these children are saying? They asked him. Yes, Jesus replied. It's as if he's saying yes, and it is music to my ears. Have you never read from the lips of children and infants you have ordained praise? From Psalm chapter 8, verse 2. From the lips of children and infants, God has ordained praise. You wonder why we value the next generation now? As a church, because they teach us what worship looks like. There is no mystery when a child is excited about something. You know it. You know it by being in their presence. Church, too often we show this world that we're excited about a lot of things. But as this world looks at your life, would they know that you are excited about the fact that you have been rescued by Jesus Christ? That you have the offer of a new start every single day. If you would just be willing to enter into a place of weakness and come to a place where you are in touch with your need.